Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Medieval Studies, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm Yana Byers, your host, and I'm here today with Sean Field, professor of history at the University of Vermont, to talk about his new book, A Female Apostle in Medieval Italy, The Life of Claire of Rimini, out this year, 2023, with the University of Pennsylvania Press. Hi, Sean, how are you today?
I'm doing very well, Yana. Thanks for having me on. How are you doing?
You know what? Also really good. Things are great. It's spring. It's nice. My semester's coming to an end. Just going to Italy in a couple months. Things are good.
What could be better?
What could be better? Yeah. And how about you? How's Vermont?
Vermont's good. Yep. It's actually sunny out today, which is a rarity in the spring in Vermont. So everybody's cheery and we're looking forward to spring arriving here, you know, sometime in the next 2 or 3 months, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And you'll have there a couple of weeks of summer. It'll be brilliant. Hey, so I mentioned your affiliation. I neglected a very important point, which is you are also, as of not too long ago, a fellow of the Medieval Academy of America. Congratulations.
Well, thanks very much. It's really a nice honor and quite a surprise. And, you know, every now and then you get a little bit of recognition in our field, and you got to soak it up while you can because it doesn't come too often.
Right. No, that's wonderful. Yeah. I got to tell you, it's when we have some mutual friends who are in the Medieval Academy. It's really nice to know that sometimes the meritocracy actually rewards merit. So, yay.
Well, that's nice of you to say, Yana. Let's hope it's true.
Yeah. No, wonderful. Congratulations. All right. So let's turn to Claire. Who is this Claire of Rimini creature about whom you write?
Well, Claire is a really fascinating medieval woman who was born about the year 1260 in the Italian town of Rimini. She has really quite a controversial and interesting life. I'll try to just encapsulate it for you quickly and we can go from there. Mm-hmm. As I said, she was born about 1260 to a family from the lower urban nobility. And in the kind of topsy-turvy political world of Italy, her family is exiled and while she's still young. And so she has a kind of a difficult childhood. Her mother dies when she's quite young. She is married off to, probably her family arranged her marriage when she's young. Her first husband dies. She gets married again, probably this time more of her own choice and for love or romance or something of the sort. But as I said in there, her family was exiled. And then when they come back to Rimini, her father is executed. And so eventually she is twice widowed and orphaned and has to make interesting choices for herself. And she ends up, you know, rejecting this life of marriage and as the hagiographer describes her, of luxury and fine foods and nice clothes, and instead adopts this life of penance and ends up living in a little single cell without a roof that's in the old Roman walls of the city of Rimini. So she's one of these 13th century women that is outside any real religious structure. She's not a nun. She's not even a member of some kind of established informal community, just this solitary kind of figure adopting this very ardent Christian piety and devoting herself to helping the poor and wandering around the streets of Rimini, gathering alms and being really quite a controversial figure, like so controversial that at one point she is accused of heresy by preachers in Rimini from the pulpit. They call her out by name and say she's possessed by a demon and she's leading the women of the town astray. And her humility is all a kind of a false guise. And really she's somebody that the husbands of town should be making sure that their wives don't associate with. But eventually she seems to have gotten through this episode and eventually starts to gather a community of women around her, kind of like-minded women. And she has to go through this process of transforming herself from this lone, controversial figure to somebody who's leading an informal, but a community of women around her. She's clearly not shy about teaching in public, preaching, we would probably say, although that word isn't like used by our contemporaries. She travels, she goes on pilgrimage to Assisi, leading a group of women. She has visions, she battles with demons. In some ways, she is just a great encapsulation of some of the most controversial, interesting, fascinating things that women on the edges of Christian communities in medieval Italy were doing. And to top it all off, she's remained really very, very little known. And so it's a new life to study, a new example to bring forth, and a really like fascinating, controversial kind of figure to study.
So how did you first meet her?
Well, that is a great question. So this book is a collaboration between myself and Jacques Dallarin, who is one of the great medieval historians in the world and one of France's great medievalists, and Valerio Capozzo, who, as you can tell from his name, is Italian, but who teaches in the United States at the University of Mississippi. And so the path to this book is that Jacques Dallarin is really the great world's expert on Claire of Rimini, because he's the one who kind of recovered her story in the 1990s and produced a critical edition of the 14th century life that was written about her, and then wrote a little bit more accessible book in French that was published in 1999. So he's the figure that had really rediscovered Claire and brought her forth to modern scholarship. And I've worked with Jacques on a number of other projects. He's a fantastic scholar and also an extremely nice guy, a great guy to work with. And I suggested to him, I think maybe just before the pandemic hit, that it was really a shame that Claire of Rimini wasn't better known, that even in Italy and France, she hadn't really taken hold, but certainly in the United States, where there's a lot of interest in these kinds of interesting medieval women, she just had, you know, kind of stayed beneath the radar, and we should do a little book that would translate her life into English and introduce her to American and Anglophone audiences. And he liked the idea. And so we ended up working on it with Valerio, really across the heart of the pandemic times when everybody was stuck in their own rooms. And we were doing this work, you know, across the Atlantic by working on screens together. It made the time go by a little more quickly there during the pandemic.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. You know, there are people who did these wonderful pandemic projects and they are much happier humans. It's very funny. Good thing. All right. So I want to talk about this book and like what it is. So the first thing, it's a translation and edition of La Vita della Beata Chiara da Rimino, la quale, for example, a tutte le donne vane. English, the life of the blessed Claire of Rimini, who was an example for all vain ladies. Which is a brilliant title. Was it in need of a new translation? Is that what happened here?
That was the origin. So the text itself, and we could talk about this process if you want, but it was written in Italian in probably the 1320s originally. So it's probably the earliest saint's life that we know of written directly in Italian rather than written in Latin and then translated into Italian. So that's one of the things that was interesting about it. And my original thought was pretty standard, pretty straightforward, as, hey, Jacques, let's translate this life into English. It's never been translated into English. It's never even been fully translated into French or any other language. Let's do a little English translation, and we'll do the kind of standard thing. We'll, you know, write up a little introduction, and we'll have a nice little book that'll be great for classrooms or for interested readers. And Jacques actually came back with a more interesting proposal, which resulted in the book that we're talking about here. He said, yeah, sure, but that's been done so many times before. Let's do something a little different. And his proposal was, let's imagine a new format for a book like this, where what we'll do is we'll just translate the first chapter of the life. And then we'll give our commentary on the issues that this first chapter opens up. And we'll think of it as a way of introducing students and readers, not just to this text, even though the text itself is super interesting, but to the whole wider world that Claire inhabited. So the text is divided into 12 chapters and an epilogue. So the way the book is set up is there's a very short little introduction to the book. We wanted to have a one-page introduction to the book, and the press eventually said, well, we get what you're doing, but let's be a little more realistic. Let's have a five-page introduction to tell the readers what's going on here. But a very short introduction to the book, and then you jump right into chapter one of the primary source text translated to English, and then a couple of pages of our commentary helping readers understand what's going on there. And then you move to chapter two of the primary source text, and our commentary follows chapter two. So it's a different organization for a book. It's a different way of trying to use a primary source text in translation to open up a whole medieval world. And so far, it seems to be getting good reaction. People seem to find that it's interesting. I've had some colleagues saying, hey, I want to do that with my next translation project. And, we'll see over the next few years how it works and what people think. But it certainly was interesting to try to reimagine this kind of format and to see how it worked out and what kind of possibilities it could open up. So we're pretty happy with it.
That is so cool. I love that. I did a translation and I did the thing. I translated the thing and we have a little introduction, but you did a micro history as well as a translation.
That's what we were going for, And the way Jacques put it, I thought this was kind of powerful. He said, well, what if you were going to lecture on or explain a medieval painting to somebody, like you're talking about a painting by Giotto or something, like you wouldn't have the painting in a back room and then talk to people for a half an hour. And then when you're done talking to them, then bring the painting out. Like you would put the painting in front of them right away, start talking immediately about what you see there. And so why not do the same thing? Like put the text in front of readers right away, let them get the excitement of it, the interest of it. Don't make them fight through a long introduction, before they get to that. Like that's not what they came for. That's not what they paid money for. Like give them the exciting stuff first, give them the dessert first, and we'll explain it to you afterwards.
Yeah. Well, and that's how you would teach it too. If you were teaching this, you would bring the text in, you'd read some of it, and then you'd riff on it. It's a really good tool.
Yeah. And so the book isn't intended only for students by any means, but certainly we're thinking about students, but also, other readers that, might not be experts in medieval Italy and certainly aren't going to read a text in medieval Italian, but that are interested in this world and the life of somebody like Claire, but also just in a wider sense. Like they don't necessarily want to really a specialized, detailed study of this text. They want to imagine themselves into this world and picture what it was like to be Claire in Rimini in the 13th and 14th century. And, just trying to imagine what these new possibilities could be for a little bit of a different format.
Yeah, it's really relatable as well. I think it's perfect. This is the kind of book that our listeners should read. They shouldn't just listen to this interview. They should go buy the book, very affordable, FYI, and read it because it is pitched in a way that is comprehensible and it's fun. It's fun to read.
Yeah. Well, it's nice of you to say that. We definitely were hoping for a pretty lively book, definitely trying to aim at readership of people who didn't have to have any previous knowledge. And, even though, people like Jacques is one of the greatest scholars in the world for medieval Italy, and Valerio is a specialist on Dante and Boccaccio and 14th century Italian literature, this was a moment to try to step back a little bit and think about in a collaborative way, what do we have to share with a wider readership that, we want to get our technical details right. We want to be accurate. We want to, be the best scholars we can, but we want a book that's going to be readable and accessible.
you know, you succeeded, but you started, you kind of set yourself up to win already because she's fascinating, right?
Yeah. So,
you know, like, as you noted, possibly the first hagiography in Italian. What are some other things you noted that are very special about this particular text? What do you want to tell us?
Well, one of the other things that is particularly unusual is that, as best we can tell, and as the argument that we make, is that it was probably written before Claire died. So we don't actually know the exact date of her death. We don't even know really the exact circumstances of her death, precisely because it is not mentioned in the text. She must have died in the 1320s, but the text gives every indication of having been written maybe while she seems to be perhaps in her last illness, or she's visibly kind of declining and everybody around her feels that she's reaching the end of her life, but written before she actually dies, which is quite unusual. There are other examples in medieval hagiography, but they're few and far between. Most of the time, a saint's life is written once the saint is, you know, safely dead, and preferably after at least a little bit of time has gone by and miracles have begun to appear at their tomb, which proves their sanctity. And so this really is an out of the ordinary kind of text, in not only the fact that it was written in Italian, but in the context, the dynamic in which it was written. So it opens up some interesting kind of questions and analytic possibilities that are pretty special to this case.
Yeah. I mean, the idea that it's written while she's still alive is fascinating. You make a pretty good case for that, but also just with people who know her, right? So you're getting really close regardless, you know?
Yeah. And so we don't know the name of the author. We argue that it's almost certainly a Franciscan, someone very close to Claire, you know, very likely her confessor. That's not for sure, but that's the most likely dynamic. And so we have this Franciscan who's writing about her life and very definitely gathering testimony from the women around her. So in a sense, you could think of it as a collaboration. Like, these are the women who knew her. It seems he also was able to talk to her biological sister who's still alive. So you can recreate the process by which he's gathering testimony and then putting it together into this life and the way he like sifts through the different memories of the women around her. So you can think of it as a kind of an interesting multi-layered, multi-stage process of collaboration and compiling of the text itself in the 14th century, which is kind of a nice kind of meta way to think about, you know, then 700 years later, we're collaborating and, you know, putting our own stamp on the book itself.
Right. Yeah. You're now part of her history. And I also think it's so nice, you know, a lot of what we get from our saints first, or, you know, sometimes it's absolute myth. It's so far away. Hagiography, you know, is often written about people who've been dead for hundreds of years. Or, you know, I'm thinking about like Bernard of Clairvaux, where they kind of had to wait for anyone who'd known him to die before anyone could say anything nice about him, you know. But this is just right there, these people who really knew her. And it's a very, it adds... A new understanding. If you are a specialist or you care about these things, you're going to understand hagiography differently.
Yeah. And this particular hagiographer seems to have had a strategy. It seems to have been a self-conscious strategy, though, you know, maybe not. Maybe it was just sort of what he arrived at. But he seems to have made the decision that when writing about what was clearly a very controversial woman, a woman who in her real life, as she walked through the streets of Rimini, she had supporters, but also detractors, she had people who thought she was a saint, but other people who thought she was a heretic, that he made the decision to put all this controversy out in the open, like put it right into the text, and then try to soften it, explain it, contextualize it, you know, to acknowledge how controversial she was, and then try to like contain that in his own text. So he could, for example, have made different kind of rhetorical choices. He could have just remained silent about some of the things that got her in trouble. Like, you ask yourself, you get to, I think it's chapter 6, is the long detailed chapter about the accusations of heresy. Why put that in there at all? Like, as a hagiographer, why not just be silent about that? Why not mention it? Or if you really felt like you had to mention it, why not be much less direct, just a little hint or something between the lines that she encountered some opposition? Instead, he just puts it right out there and hammers home how preachers from the pulpit in Rimini are excoriating her, are calling her a heretic, or saying she's possessed by a demon. And I think we think that he adopted this strategy of like acknowledging that and then trying to contain that episode by putting it within, like between two other episodes that show how God actually favored her and God actually brought it about that episode, you know, would pass over and she would come to be seen as more of a saintly figure. And, you know, if we're right about thinking that he's doing this self-consciously, it may be related to the fact that he's writing while she's still alive. Everybody who's going to read this life in the short term knows who she was and has not forgotten these things and saw her in the streets and knew exactly what had happened. And it probably seemed like it just wouldn't work to like skip over these things. So the point being that we end up with a text which is really fascinating to read 700 years later, precisely because of those strategies or those decisions to lay all her most controversial elements right out there in the open. You know, in some ways, as a saint's life, it means, you know, maybe in a certain way, it didn't really work. Like as a potential saint, she clearly raises a lot of problems. But as a historical document that lets us see some of the realities of what's going on, it's fabulous.
Yeah, very cool. Absolutely. You know, and then there's all this stuff about her that's just so unique. Not, I mean, like, she's not unique isn't the right word, but notable, worth talking about. So just there's a few of these things I really want to talk about. Let's start talking about the second chapter. The part where she goes from being a wealthy wife with all of the possible comforts the era could offer and then becomes this kind of fiercely devoted, really ascetic nun. First of all, I think we want to talk about how this is explained and then kind of what you have to offer. So what does our author tell us about her decisions and how this happens? Yeah.
So some of the ways that he describes this process seem, you know, fairly expected and the kind of thing that you might find in other sorts of saint lives, but in some ways it's a little unusual. So first of all, it's relatively unusual, not as unusual by this time as it would have been a few centuries earlier, but it's relatively unusual to find someone being written about, particularly a woman being written about as a saint when she has been married, when she's been married twice, in fact. So, you know, virginity is often a sort of a starting point for the idea of holiness or sanctity, particularly for women in the Middle Ages. And Claire has been married not once, but twice. And so the hagiographer is, you know, rhetorically stressing how much she wallowed in the sinfulness of luxurious living. And, you know, more or less the implication is that she had a healthy, enjoyable sex life with her second husband. And he stresses how they had, you know, lots of nice food and nice clothes. And, you know, he's really piling it on in order to make the conversion process more dramatic. But basically, he describes, even before her second husband is dead, that she has a vision in the Franciscan church of Rimini, and the Virgin Mary appears to her and basically uses some pretty straightforward like logic and rhetoric to say, you know, why are you so invested in this earthly husband and all these nice things that you can enjoy on earth when they're going to be fleeting and transitory and they'll go away very quickly. And Claire begins this process of turning away from the world towards this life of penance, even before her second husband dies. And then, conveniently enough, he dies shortly thereafter, and she's left as a widow and with, you know, with the chance to fully leave the world behind, since that's what she wants to do.
But she didn't have to fully leave the world behind, right? I mean, I think probably when people conceive of the medieval period, they imagine she could only be a nun, but she didn't have to only be a nun. She could have done other things.
It's true, particularly as a respectable widow, and her family had certainly come from a certain amount of comfort and social status. And shortly after this, you know, I mentioned that her father had already been executed, but she has a surviving older brother who is also exiled, and she goes to join him in the not too far away town of Urbino. And so, yeah, she could have had the option of maybe living with her brother or allowing her brother to, you know, provide for her in some way. And clearly that's not what she wants. So there is this move towards penance, which for sure you can find in many, many saints' lives. But her vision of what she wants to do is definitely quirkier. So first in Urbino, she ends up associating herself closely with a particular canon of the cathedral at Urbino, who apparently she confesses to and she has a spiritual relationship to, and that the hagiographer describes her as like so invested in penance that she's constantly crying and constantly wailing and really creating a bit of a nuisance for herself, so that her neighbors, including the canons, the churchmen of the Cathedral of Urbino, basically tell her, you have to shut up or leave. Like, we can't take all of your penitential wailing anymore. And so she agrees to calm down a little bit. But then when she and her brother return to Rimini, that's when she adopts this unexpected life of just finding this little, it's described as a little cell without a roof in the old half ruined Roman walls of Rimini. So, you know, exactly how should we picture this? You know, it's a little unclear, but you know, just a small little room, and it's very clear, like that when the rain comes down, she gets soaking wet. Like, it's not even really a dwelling. It's just like a little square that she's kind of squatting in, and she's making this into her home. And the hagiographer uses a really interesting phrase, that what she was seeking and what she finds here first is a room of her own. And of course, it's a fascinating phrase for modern audiences, because we go immediately to Virginia Woolf, and you know, obviously the temptation to see somebody like Claire as though she's a sort of proto-modern feminist is probably to avoid it. You know, she wouldn't have understood Virginia Woolf if she could have met Virginia Woolf. But it's not entirely anachronistic to say that she clearly wants some kind of autonomy. She doesn't want to live with her brother. She doesn't want to become a nun. She wants this kind of ability to carve out this penitent life on her own terms. So in that sense, she is definitely finding a way as a woman specifically to live this penitent life on her own terms, which I think is fascinating.
How common is this? Is this a thing that women are doing all over, finding their own roofless huts? And
yeah, well, it might sometimes almost seem like, if you read a lot of saints' lives like I do, and the world that we're in, Jana, you sometimes get the feeling you read about Marjorie Kemp and you read about Margherita of Cortona, and you get this feeling that these penitent women are just wandering through the streets of Italy and England, like crying at the top of their lungs. And but of course, really, these are very small numbers of people. And so much more common would have been either joining a nunnery or at least joining one of the kind of informal communities that, you know, we might call them Beguine communities in northern France, or different names for them in Italian towns. But, you know, at least something with a little bit of structure. So a woman from what was originally, you know, an upper class family who is living in a little cell without a roof is definitely unusual. This is definitely a strange path that she has chosen for herself.
Right. And then this, her extreme, harsh asceticism. Yeah. Well, you can talk about what that looks like for her.
Yeah. I mean, again, this is the kind of thing that you expect to find in saints' lives, and particularly, you know, there's been a lot of great scholarship on this, particularly when male authors write about female saints. They have a tendency to really try to demonstrate sanctity by the extent to which these women's bodies are put through various kinds of ascetic behaviors and suffering, having often to do with denying themselves food, with, you know, physically making sure that they never feel comfortable. They might wear hair shirts, like something that means that your skin is always constantly painful and itching, or denying themselves sleep. Mm-hmm. And this author definitely, you know, fully embraces this kind of rhetoric of showing Claire embracing like a kind of penance, which isn't just interior, but definitely involves a lot of bodily suffering. And particularly around the idea of food, there's a great moment that kind of shows the way this text tends to, you know, it does embrace themes that you find in lots of saints' lives, but it always seems to take them one step further. And there's this scene where she's feeling like a guilt for all the nice food that she ate back when she was a married woman and living a comfortable life. And she has one of her female companions go and get her a toad, and she roasts up this toad and she chops it up and she eats it, as disgusting as this is, like to cure her of any like lingering desire to have nice food. So it's a really graphic example that this hagiographer is giving us, the lengths to which she's going to break herself of the habits of, you know, enjoying physical comforts in the world.
But so we've got this trope that we all know that like female embodied, like sanctity has to be embodied in females and like women, and you know, women are, because female bodies are more problematic. So, okay, we've got this thing. And so, yeah, then she doesn't just starve herself. She doesn't just like, whatever, eat gruel. She is a toad. So the thing there, kind of demonstrating also this idea of, you know, it's an example for vain ladies. Like we're going away with our vanity, but she still has companions she has someone to go fetch her toad as well. So how is her life then?
Yeah. And eventually, this is clearly a real tension in the text. And I think we could say a real tension in her life. The moment when she moves from being this solitary penitent to wanting to build up a community around her. And again, you know, visions often play like key moments in texts like this. She receives a vision where she becomes clear that this is what God wants her to do. And there's apparently a landlord, kind of a little house, we can imagine it down the street from her cell. The hagiographer tells us his name is Lapo. And he basically comes to her and offers to sell her his house so that she could have a place, not so much for herself. It's not that she wants more comfort for herself, but a place that's big enough that the women who are starting to gravitate around her could start to form a community. And she clearly wants this, but she clearly feels overwhelmingly guilty about this. Like, is she betraying her penitent ideals by leaving her little cell behind? What about the whole question of buying this house? It's going to cost money. Like, she can beg for alms and build up a little bit of cash. Like, but this is going to be an all cash real estate transaction. Like, she is going to be the owner of this house once she does this. So she's no longer going to be living this kind of Franciscan influenced life of rejecting money, of living in poverty. There are responsibilities that come with, you know, owning a house. And she clearly is torn by this. And so she does buy the house. But then we get another one of these scenes where the hagiographer describes there's like immediately like retreating back to her cell and inflicting all this punishment on her body to like convince herself and like textually to convince the reader that she's still as absolutely like penitent as she had been before. So you can see it's a difficult moment for this like charismatic solitary figure to become the leader of a community. Is not easy at all for her psychologically.
I mean, isn't there a cynical interpretation here of how she did everything exactly right, to get the power and that to be able to exercise power in this particular way that works for women?
Yeah, I don't know if I would call it cynical, though you certainly could. If we're thinking about her real life and what the challenges were for her, she is, I would agree with you, she ends up being quite effective. Like, she is effectively able to build up this life where she's moved from this, you know, really marginal penitent in a cell to becoming a figure who has a certain kind of standing in the community. It's like the leader. These are the sisters of Claire. These are the sisters, the community that's building up around her. And she clearly does find the way to make this happen. The hagiographer writing about her clearly wants to emphasize how she remains as humble as ever and as penitent as ever. And that could be partly just a rhetorical effect of the hagiographer wanting to reassure us. But I tend to think that she really in her real life did have this real conflict in her, that she was not so like cynical that she's just trying to calculate, like, I always wanted influence in this city. How can I get influence in this city? That it really is a difficult move for her psychologically to accept that she's going to have to handle money and buy a house and that new responsibilities come with being a leader of these women. Like, you know, in some ways it's the same kind of psychological battle that we see with much more famous figures like, say, Francis of Assisi, who always struggles with what it means to be the leader of what eventually is thousands of brothers that are, you know, joining the Franciscan order, or Clara of Assisi, who is, you know, the abbess of her own house of Franciscan women, but always struggles with what it means to be an abbess with authority over other sisters when all she ever wanted was humility and poverty. Like, it's a dynamic that we see in other kind of charismatic religious leaders who end up being, you know, in charge of other people who want to follow them. And have psychologically, that's a big step for them to take.
Right.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, and it's possible that I'm not surprised to hear you talking about it this way, because this is, after reading the book, I've felt that her, I didn't feel like it was some cynical ploy. Like, I didn't feel like she was just the most cold person ever. One other thing, though, that I just want to ask you about, because she read to me very much like Frances, but I know what happened with Frances's Claire. Like, Frances's Claire has to go be very traditional and go locked away. And she seems to get to be more of a Frances than a Claire.
That is a really interesting point, Yana. I think it's fair to say that although Claire of Rimini was well aware of Claire of Assisi and her tradition, she associates with poor Claire nuns. She's well aware of what that life is. But Claire of Rimini is really following the model of Frances, not the model of Claire of Assisi. She does not show any interest in becoming an enclosed nun. She wants to be out in the streets. She definitely teaches in public. The hagiographer is careful never to use the word preaching because, you know, that the medieval church frowned on women preaching. But for all intents and purposes, she preaches in public. She teaches in public. She works with the poor. She is really, you know, following that mendicant model, that Franciscan model of being engaged out there in the streets and the piazza of Rimini. So I think your observation is right on target, that she is really following Frances more than she's following Claire of Assisi, which is what makes it so interesting. It's what Claire of Assisi's original dilemma was, like, how can a woman in medieval society be able to do these things? The church, the town fathers, the secular government, nobody is that keen on having women preaching in the streets, begging in the streets, wandering in the streets. And so it's a very, very delicate kind of balancing act for her. And it's definitely what makes her so controversial.
Well, I mean, and Claire of Assisi, to my knowledge, didn't have the problems that Claire of Rimini is going to run into, right? Like, Claire of Assisi there is no hint of heresy as far as I remember about her.
Yeah, definitely not. Claire had her own kind of battles, and Claire of Assisi was equally fascinating, but definitely in a different kind of way.
Yeah, so, I mean, you talk about heresy. What's Claire doing? What does it mean in this context? How does that read?
Great question. There's really not a strong sense that she's accused of some kind of doctrinal heresy, that she's accused of advocating ideas that are clearly unacceptable to the church. Basically, what she seems to be being accused of is just rebelliousness, insubordination, causing problems for the town. That the word that the preacher uses is, he calls her a patterine. And it's the same word in Italian, basically, as in modern English. And this is a term that, you know, went back to the 11th century and first referred to, like, lay people that were agitating on behalf of the movement known as the Gregorian Reform and were insisting on more purity for the church. But by the 13th, 14th century, it's become in Italian kind of a catch-all word for a heretic, but like a heretic who is basically a rebel, just like a problem, somebody who doesn't obey the church. And so that's the term that's being thrown at her. And, you know, it's a loaded word that the hagiographer describes as he's trying to give you a portrayal of what Claire is going through this year where she's being accused of heresy. And he says the children of Rimini followed her through the streets, throwing stones at her, saying, "It's the Paterine." You picture these little Italian kids like mocking her with the term Paterine and throwing stones at her, which, you know, obviously is not funny if you're the one having stones thrown at you, but it's a little bit of a comic scene in retrospect. And, you know, it's just this sense that when she's at the height of her controversy, these preachers who might have been, you know, more conservative Franciscans or could conceivably have been Dominicans or other preachers are just not happy with the influence of this woman who is not under anyone's control, not under church control, really. She's not married. Her husband is long dead. Her father is long dead. And clearly she thinks that she's on this path of holiness, but what's she really doing? She's wandering through the streets, making a spectacle of herself, begging for alms, presuming to teach lessons to people. And this is the problem. She is overstepping her position, her bounds. She is causing problems. And this is really what they're accusing her of.
So to be clear, there's a gendered component here, right? Like, no question. We don't like women doing this.
Yeah, no question at all. And there's an interesting line in this chapter where at first the preacher who's accusing her of all this, at least as he's quoted by the hagiographer, seems to be talking to everybody in Rimini. But by the time he's done, he concludes by saying, "Husbands, don't let your wives associate with her." So there's a very clear sense that this is a question of women causing problems and needing to be under control.
Sure. Not a lot of men got away with that either. Like, this is borderline behavior regardless. Yeah.
That's a fair point. So, you know, men wandering in the streets begging are not necessarily very welcome if they're not part of an established mendicant order. Franciscans or Dominicans doing that might have one thing. So that's a fair point that we shouldn't chalk everything up to gender all the time.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. This is a gender story, but I mean, like, this is just problematic behavior. You just don't want ranting, starving people in your streets necessarily.
Fair point, Jana.
Yeah, but no, gender. It's always gender, Sean. So I wanted to talk a little bit more about her visions as well. So she has loads of visions. What are people having visions? Is this a normal thing?
Yeah. So obviously visionary culture is a big part of Christianity in the 13th and 14th century. People who are perceived as saints or having a particular holiness or a contact with God, not always, but often might report having some kind of moment where they feel as though God is speaking to them, or God has appeared to them, or the Virgin Mary, or a particular saint. So finding this kind of thing in the saint's life is certainly not unusual. And some of Claire's visions are, you know, more or less standard sort of things. I mentioned like her having a vision of the Virgin Mary, where the Virgin Mary urges her to a life of penance. It's interesting, but not like, you know, out of it's not a crazily out of order thing to find in a saint's life. Some of her visions are a little bit less expected. The most famous one, the one that we have on the cover for the book and the one that provides the best known artwork about Claire that was done just after her death, is this vision that she has of Jesus and John the Evangelist and John the Baptist and a whole choir of saints, where Jesus shows her the wound in her side and holds out a book with a biblical passage in it to her, and basically is kind of acknowledging her prayers and her requests and really is signaling his approval for everything that she's doing. And obviously on a podcast, you know, we can't look at this image here together. But if you buy the book, you can look at it there. And so this is the center of a beautiful triptych that's painted for her community just after her death, where on the left wing of the triptych has the scene where the Magi come to visit the Virgin Mary and the baby Jesus, and the center of the triptych has the crucifixion scene with Francis of Assisi kind of down by the feet of Jesus. And then the right panel of the triptych shows Claire and this vision and her receiving this book from from John the Evangelist, who was receiving it from from Jesus, and it gives you a sense of like how effective apparently she must have been at conveying these visions. So we know that she must have talked about it to her sisters, who then report it to this hagiographer, or maybe she reported it directly to the hagiographer, and then he writes it down in this life, and then after her death, it becomes the text that he's written down becomes the source for this work of visual art. So it's kind of an interesting kind of circular process there, and you know, definitely gives us our best visual clue to how she was seen at the time and how she was represented through these visions.
And I'm thinking about this dialectic of like this the vision creating a vision, but this is a visual culture, right?
Yes.
And
in fact, this is it's a little bit difficult to talk about this in detail when we just have our voices to describe these visual images. But Jacques Dallarin, who I mentioned was the guy who really did the groundbreaking work on Claire, he actually demonstrated, it's really fascinating, that the imagery from this vision seems to have been drawn from a particular church in Rimini. It's the Church of Sant'Agostino, the Augustinian church in Rimini, where there was a brand new program of frescoes that were painted about 1318. And we can be pretty sure that Claire was in that church, and she's probably looking at these paintings, and she's probably meditating. And then the images from these frescoes seem to have informed then what she sees in this vision. So there's this long chain of like, you know, this painting's done in 1318 and Claire meditating on them, and then her having this vision, and then the vision being written down in her hagiography, and then the text of the hagiography being used as the starting point for the paintings that are made about her. It's really a fascinating chain of images, visions, texts that Jacques does a wonderful job of drawing out. And we try to explain that in the chapter 11 or 12 of the book, where this vision is, I think it's chapter 11, where this vision is related.
And a description of a vision is going to be this clue that says a lot more to somebody in, you know, 1320 or whatever, than it says to us.
Right. Yeah, very possibly. Like, it really takes some drawing out for a modern audience to like try to explain what the various images probably meant to Claire and to an audience. So it's a fascinating process. And plus, it's just a beautiful triptych. There's vivid colors, beautiful gold painting. Made a nice cover for the book. Like, you know,
it's gorgeous. Yeah, absolutely. I'll need to go back to Rimini. And then she battles demons.
Yeah. And this is, again, not unusual, at least not totally unusual, for saints' lives in the later Middle Ages. And, you know, demons as a force that demonstrate that somebody who's seeking holiness, somebody who sees themselves as holy, somebody that is being portrayed as holy, when demons show up to attack them or tempt them, that's in a certain way like a proof that they really are holy. Like, they are worth attacking. They're a high value target for Satan, we might say. And so it's not totally unusual to find that towards the end of this text, the hagiographer is describing demons besetting Claire. But it's a little bit, in a number of ways, like this text from the early 14th century sometimes feels like it's at the beginning of larger themes that are just developing. You're more likely, as you get to the end of the 14th century, early 15th century, to find that it's almost like required for a saint's life, particularly of women, to show them being like constantly under siege by demons and constantly questioning when they have visions, like asking themselves, was this really a vision of saintly figures or angels or something sent by God? Or was this actually a delusion sent by demons? Like, this sense that demons are ever more present in the imagination of late medieval people seems like a valid conclusion to draw. And so this text from the early 14th century is a little like ahead of its time, a little precocious in like insisting on the role of demons in this portrayal of her sanctity.
So tell me, you seem convinced she's the real deal. Yeah.
The real deal in the sense that like she really was a saintly figure, not deluded by demons. And
yeah, maybe that. The saintly figure, not deluded by demons, probably directly connected to God.
Yeah. It's not for me to say whether she was directly connected to God, but I have this strong feeling, and, you know, readers are perfectly welcome to come to their own conclusions. People who, you know, historians and editors have a strong tendency to become identified with the people that they're studying, and, you know, either to love them or to sometimes to really hate them and to become kind of identified in that sense. But, you know, I have the strong feeling that Claire was an extraordinary personality, and did some extraordinary things, had a life that was very much out of the ordinary. And that's why she's been being written about in this text for us. And at the same time, as we study this extraordinary life, we do get a picture of everything that's going on around her and a little bit more of a sense of like the everyday life in Italian city-state that she's walking through. Even if she's so controversial, she does let us get little pictures of things like how were families organized, what was a father's authority or a husband's authority in a family, what were marriages like, you know, how did the justice system work in a city-state like Rimini, all these little, you know, contexts that we have to understand to grasp her life. So it's a mix of the extraordinary and the ordinary that we're hoping to bring out.
Yeah, she is there's a devotion and purpose to her life that I find really impressive. Yeah, and I wanted to talk about the things that I'm particularly into today, but there's something for everybody. Really, you can just, there are so many places that you talk about, and just like quotidian existence in medieval Italy in this way, you know, is pretty hard to find, actually. It's really nice. So I have taken up way more than enough of your time. So I'll, like, you know, just one more quick question, and this is an easy one. I hope it should be an easy one. So what are you working on next? What's next?
I've been working on a lot of things recently, but the next thing that I'm starting, I'll actually be on sabbatical next year. Should be at the National Humanities Center in North Carolina. And I'm starting a book about female hagiographers, women writing lives of other women. So in this little chat we've been talking about some of these gender dynamics, about men writing about women. And this is certainly not a field that's never been studied, but I really want to get more deeply into it, open this up, and think about what a text look like when female authors write about female saintly figures in the Middle Ages and kind of turn the tables on that gender dynamic. So I hope that's what I'm doing next.
That should be fun. And North Carolina will be a little, that should be a nicer winter anyway.
Hoping for a little warmer weather in the winter next year than we have here in Vermont.
Yeah, that sounds delightful, actually. I'm looking forward to the next work. All right.
Thanks so much.
Oh, thank you so much for joining me. It has been wonderful, and I hope we talk again soon.
Looking forward to it, Jana. Thanks.